This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. There was once a time when the unexpected happened on radio, and perhaps no one remembers that time as well as Studs Terkel, who began his career in radio with a weekly music program called The Wax Museum. Terkel got to play whatever he wanted, from opera to jazz to folk, an eclectic mix that reflected no one's taste but his own. He went on to become well-known for his oral histories of everyday life and the unsung hero. Terkel chronicled the trials and tribulations of ordinary men and women in his book Working, and their hopes and disappointments in American dreams lost and found. Now, at the age of 93, he's come full circle to his early love of music and the radio show that started his conversation with America. In his latest book, And All They Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey, he's collected interviews that reflect his diverse taste in music, ranging from opera to jazz, classical to the blues, as well as folk and rock. And Studs Terkel joins me now in Studio 3A. Welcome. So good to have you.
Well, thank you very much, Lynn.
If you have a question for Studs Terkel, join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. You know, I have to say, when I was reading the introduction to your book, and you were describing your early days in radio, it made me nostalgic for a time when, you know, radio was the kind of place where anything could happen. Just what was it like when you were first starting out?
Well, I first started out as a gangster in radio soap operas.
Uh-huh.
Chicago had more radio soap operas than New York and Hollywood put together. And they all were the same. You know, Guiding Light was about a young minister. Woman in White, obviously, about a young nurse.
Yeah.
And the strips were all, and the gangsters were all the same. Chicago gangsters. And there were three, usually three. The bright one, the middle one, the dumb one. I was always the dumb one.
So can you still do the voice? Can you still do that gangster's voice?
Well, that's just not, you know, for example, let's say Cynthia is the heroine. If you don't come with me right now, you know what's going to happen to you, Cynthia. You know, so you do that. You do the same role all the time, the same thing.
Yeah.
And an agency man liked me for other reasons. I was also with the Labor Theater Group at the time. The WPA was on, WPA Theater. I was a member by this time of the Writers Theater, but there was a WPA Theater, and they did plays like The Cradle of Rock that was made into a movie by Tim Robbins. And in the book, this book, which we're talking about the adventures of an eclectic disc jockey. The key word is eclectic.
That's right.
I would choose anything. So I became a commentator on the air, but also a disc jockey. Before the word disc jockey entered our working vocabulary.
And I don't think people think of you as a disc jockey.
No, they think of me as an oral biographer. And it sounds fancy and it's good and I accept it and I like it. But I'm at heart a disc jockey. And so it's not just playing popular songs. I wasn't interested in that. These are some interviews that took place 50 years ago. One, for example, what was Caruso? Who would I play? I'd play Caruso doing an aria from L'Apricon of Meyerbeer. Vasco da Gama discovered something new. Oh, Paradiso. And I opened with Caruso, who was sort of the unsung hero of this book, because at the turn of the century, immigrants, no matter how hardworking they were, no matter how poor they were, bought a Caruso record.
Yeah, yeah.
He, in fact, established the Victrola industry because his voice had that extra something that John Chardy, the poet, said, expresses the possibilities in man, mm-hmm. ordinary people, not yet tapped. You think he has hit the highest note when he goes one step further.
You didn't interview Caruso. You said
wish I did. I interviewed a couple of divas who sang with him, and one was the great one, Edith Mason, about 50 years ago. Edith Mason was known for Cho Cho San and Madame Butterfly, that delicate voice, singing One Fine Day He'll Come Back, the American Lover, who won't, of course. Un Bel David Ramo. And then she starts talking, and it's Irish street talk. So I said to this guy, The same one as Chaucer. I sang with Caruso. He was a generous-hearted guy, great. Always offered you a drink. He's very nervous. Oh. He's like a young tenor about to sing in Parma. Parma's Toscanini's hometown, where opera is like football. Thumbs up, thumbs down. It's a terrifying town, the young tenors. Caruso was like one of them.
Yeah.
Even when he was the greatest name in the world.
Yeah.
One day, this guy Caruso is crazy, she says. He's a good-hearted guy. One day he calls me up. I'm in a jail in Chicago. He's in jail. I'll come. The lady who sat next to me on the bench near the zoo, and I pinch her, you know, you pinched her fanny? Yeah, I pinched her fanny. You crazy nut. Why, he's going to bail him out, and the cops are all in awe. His name was the most famous in the world. Oh, my God. He's none of mine. Oh, my God. If he does that again, pinches a woman's fanny, put him in forever. But she's in the book, and she describes herself an overage, overweight singer. So I go from a Caruso record, say, to Louis Armstrong's West End Blues.
Ooh,
it's my favorite. And that's where Earl Hines plays a certain kind of piano with him. That's revolutionary. And then I go from there, I might go to Woody Guthrie singing Tom Joad.
And was it just the way it hit you, what you wanted to play at that moment? Is
you
that what
bet.
It was?
It's just what I felt like at that moment. I felt like. And if I felt like it, maybe other people do. And if they don't, maybe they will. But the big thing is never to play down to people, but to play up to what the possibilities are. I think I've always felt that. I don't mean to be romantic about it, but... See, for his wonderful case in point, there was a marvelous book called Aikenfield by a British writer, Ronald Blythe. It's about a village, part of the Village series. My book was one of them, Division Street America. And it's about a village near London, and this is a working man. He's highly intelligent, but he feels that classical music of Brahms, of Mahler, of Schubert is not for him. It's for the people he sees opening night at the opera and the tabloids, tiaras and furs and top hat. Maybe it's for them. But one day, to get in out of the rain, it may have been in Manchester, he finds himself in the symphony hall, and he opens the door slightly, and hears some music, and it's Mozart. And as he listens, and it suddenly hits him, he loves this music. He does understand it. He is good enough for Mozart. So in a sense, what I'm really saying is, if people hear good things often enough, whether it be jazz or blues or spirituals or folk music or classical or Andre Segovia playing the guitar, they'll like it.
You know, you mentioned a little short time ago that you might play Louis Armstrong, and one of the interviews in this book is with Louis Armstrong, and we have a little clip of tape from that interview. We're gonna play that tape now.
We copied it from them, and then beat, tom toms, drum beats, and all that. I realized when I went down there that it was copied from them.
So the rhythms, the complicated rhythms in African in origin, when slaves came here originally, brought the particular
the
music
Africans.
With them. So when you went back then, it was almost as though a circle was completed. Music came there and you were bringing
brought
it back.
Brought me back to generations. I was a kid in Africa, in New Orleans. I could see so many things that was brought from Africa, all over the world.
And that was Louis Armstrong in 1962, and he was telling you about his understanding that jazz music, the African roots of
the
music.
That's the first time he visited West Africa, and where he felt the music he played as a kid in New Orleans came from. You see, the thing about that interview, pardon me, that saddened me, he was so tired. He didn't have to submit to that interview. I don't know why he did. Because he was so tired, he was keeping faith with his agents. He was playing at a place that didn't care about jazz. He's established the world over, and yet he was playing that night, tired. His upper lip had a blister the size of a dime. That's from blowing on the trumpet, the embouchure. And I remember that. I said to him, I remember saying, look, we can postpone this. No, no, let's do it. And that grin, we always associate the grin. That grin was hiding something deep. There was a hurt there many times. He speaks of that in an oblique sort of way. But it's there throughout, you see. And then it opened with his first wife, Lil Hardin Armstrong. And she's wonderful. She's got a joy of life. And she taught Louis respect for himself when he came to Chicago to join his mentor, King Oliver, whom he worshipped, mm-hmm. who was a good man. But she, Lil, was telling Louis, you respect yourself first. And in any event, we have all sorts of people in the book that you wouldn't expect to be in, but, and it doesn't matter what the form is. Andre Segovia was mentioned, the man who established the classical guitar as a serious musical instrument. Until he came along, it was there, but there was hardly any repertoire. And much of the repertoire are his transcriptions of Bach. And here you got this 85-year-old guy, not an electrified instrument, acoustic instrument, a delicate one, the classical guitar, and he's got one piece of prop, a footstool, and he said he is holding 5,000 people at Ann Arbor, and they're listening, leaning forward, hearing every note. And he says, some people bawled me out once because I played so softly. They had to lean over to listen. So you know what I did the next time? I played even more softly. You know why? So they would listen more. And he describes this, and suddenly you realize that listening is a key.
Yeah.
But the different ways of listening, different instruments. You can listen to a piano and lean back, but you can't do it the way the guitar. But he describes the guitar as his lover, his paramour, and he kids about it. But I'm sorry, you were going to ask me something.
We're going to take a short break right now,
sure.
And we're going to continue our discussion with you when we come back. Studs Terkel is my guest today. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Lynn Nearing. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neil Conan. And I'm joined in the studio this hour by Studs Terkel. He's worked as an activist, a civil servant, a labor organizer, a radio DJ, a television actor. But today we're talking about his famous interviews with musicians. If you'd like to reminisce about a favorite Studs Terkel moment or ask what Janis Joplin was really like, you're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. And you can hear full interviews of Studs Terkel with some of his interviews with Louis Armstrong, Pete Seeger, Bob Dylan at our website, npr.org. And before I played a bit of tape from an interview that you had done with Louis Armstrong, and there was one other one I wanted to play right now, but you seem to want to say something.
Just a word. You were playing the opening passage of my favorite jazz record, West End Blues. That would follow the Caruso, say. See, and what you heard, what the audience heard, was his horn and his voice as one. He couldn't tell anymore where his voice began or his horn left off. And that's part of the essence of a genius, when his instrument and himself are part of him.
What was the first kind of music that you fell in love with, like when you were a young person, before you had these radio shows?
I don't know. It might have been I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, Pretty Bubbles in the Air, a popular song of the period.
Yeah.
After World War One or during it, something like Down the Road to Tipperary. But I heard, in immigrant homes, I heard Caruso records.
Or yeah.
I say Caruso, scratch and awe. Even the scratch, because there were scratchy records after a while, even the scratch added to the vividness of the memory.
Yeah. Yeah.
To hear that voice. But then I used to hear blues.
You love the blues, right?
Now, you see, I was going to University of Chicago Law School, and I disliked it. You know, I dreamed of Clarence Darrow, and I woke up to Justice Scalia. So it wasn't for me. So I was a streetcar student. That is, I would change because I lived at a hotel near North Side. And so I'd stop off at the Black Belt to change, and that's when I heard the blues and spirituals coming through the windows, through the doors of all of these shops. Now, there's a difference between the spiritual and the gospel song.
Yeah.
And in the book, Professor Thomas A. Dorsey, not Tommy Dorsey, Professor Thomas A. Dorsey, who was once known as Georgia Tom, who played the blues for Ma Rainey, who was the teacher of Bessie Smith. And his wife died, and he was saved, religiously saved. And he wrote gospel songs.
Uh-huh.
Gospel songs are of the North. They followed the Civil War. The good news music. Mahalia's song I first heard was Move On Up a Little Higher. And it's a voice such as the Welsh would call special.
Well, you know what's interesting about you also is you were just saying that some of the first songs that you loved as a young person were from around World War One, and yet among the people that you interviewed, and we have some tape from this interview, is someone who was sort of a heroine of my generation many years later, Janis Joplin, who you interviewed in 1968. And we have a clip of that tape. You asked her about her musical influences, and here's that tape.
Anthony, you mentioned Billie Holiday, so apparently then Billie has had an effect on you, too.
Not really as much as people would like to think. I listen to her a lot, but, like, she has... I don't have any of her subtlety. Same way that I don't think Aretha Franklin's had much effect on my singing. Like, Otis Redding has had a lot of effect on my singing, but Aretha Franklin is a lot more subtle. I'm more of a driver than
the dynamo. Involved.
Yeah, than it's going to take me a few
shouter.
Years.
The phrase used to use years ago was blues shouter.
Yeah, well, see, I've only been singing like really about 2 years, so I don't have it down yet. That's all.
The sad part about that, she was saying it's going to take me a few years, and of course, she died so young.
You see, I remember she was life at full tide. Now, many of her listeners, this is an old ballroom that was empty, but it was full that night. And most of those kids were stoned. It was half lit. They were stoned. But the one who wasn't stoned, though she was full of Southern comfort, and it was a horrible drink, by the way, and so she glistened. She had so much juice in her. She came from a rather depressing town, Port Arthur, Texas, oil. But in the midst of all that was this girl, this young woman, who had such juice to her. And this took place before she sang her great one, Me and Bobby McGee, which has the great lyric of Kris Kristofferson. I love that lyric. Freedom's just another word for nothing left to lose. Mm-hmm. You talk about it being a contemporary phrase today, the world over. That's it. But she had that extra juice.
I got to get some callers in here. I know there's a lot of people that want to talk with you. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 800-989-8255. I've been trying to keep Studs Terkel all to myself, but I'm going to let the audience in now. Jason, calling from Muscatine, Louisiana, is it?
Iowa,
okay. Hi, go ahead, Jason.
Well, first, I just want to say, sir, that it's an honor to finally find out what exactly you do. I grew up with grandparents from the Great Depression and parents a little younger than that, and I've heard your name in so many contexts and places, it's almost been a myth until now. So it's nice to finally find out what exactly you do. My question is this, and I'd be more than happy to take the answer off the air. In all the interviews that you've done and people letting you into their lives and then finding out what happened to them before and after, is there a single theme or lesson that you could distill all of their experiences down to? And thank you very much.
You know, it's a good question, but it's almost impossible to answer. Each one had something. This Peggy Terry, an Appalachian woman, little formal education. She came here during the 60s when many mountain people came to the South, as well as black people, the migration to work in the mills that by that time beginning to close. And Peggy had a way of talking that was just innately poetic. And she was just a natural. There's the ex-Klan leader, C.P. Ellis, who belonged to the Klan all his life, but bit by bit by bit, something was happening to him, and he became a leading advocate of Martin Luther King at the end. See, these are two I name, Nancy Jefferson, the daughter of a sharecropper, who taught her, as she said, an example in phonics. You break down the word like you break down cotton. When you pick cotton, you know, you break it up to fit it in that bag you drag. And so it was a lesson, and he was using his work form, the most humble of all, picking cotton, as a way to teach you to speak and break down words. But there is no one person. That would be very difficult. Each one, I'll tell you a very quick story that may help answer the question. I was interviewing the days of the public housing project being very new, and this was a mixed project. It was about 50 years ago, and I can't remember if the woman, and it was white or black, she was light-skinned, she's very pretty, very skinny, and bad teeth because couldn't afford a dentist, and about three little kids from about 4 to 6 years old are jumping around. They want to hear Mama's voice on the tape recorder. And she'd never spoken before on tape recorder. So I say to the kids, you be quiet, and I'll play your Mama's voice. And so as she's listening to her voice for the first time in her life, she hears a phrase. And she puts her hand to her mouth and says, oh, my God. And I said, what is it? She says, I never knew I felt that way before. Well, bingo for me and bingo for her. That's the kind of stuff that excites me very much.
That's the kind of thing you want to hear when you're an interviewer, when you're interviewing somebody, something that you didn't even know you were going for, something you didn't even know you were going to get from
person. And something she didn't know.
Right, exactly. Felt. That's the best kind. Let's take another call. Gail in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hi, Gail.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Mr. Turkle, I recently saw Martin Scorsese's film about Bob Dylan. I don't know if you saw it, but it made a huge impression on me. I saw Bob Dylan in a way that I never had before. He was interviewed now in his present life. And I found the way he spoke and the things he was saying to be so, I don't know, out there, just so different from any kind of conventional artist that I'd ever heard. And I want you, if you could, to go back to the interview that you took of him and talk a little bit of your impression when you met him.
All right, thanks for that. And before I get Mr. Turkle to respond, Gail, I'm going to play some tape we have of a Bob Dylan interview that Studs Terkel did back in 1963. And thanks for your call, Gail.
I saw Woody once a long, long time ago in Burbank, California, which was when I was just a little boy. I don't even remember seeing him, you know. And I heard him play.
That's interesting. You say when you were a very little boy.
Yeah, it was about, I think it must have been about 10.
Who took you here? Your parents?
No,
took
it was my uncle. That
your uncle took you and you were very small.
Yeah.
And that was a memory. You remember, though.
Yeah,
don't you?
I remembered Woody that time, yeah.
What was it stuck in your mind?
That, it stuck in my mind that he was Woody. And everybody else I could see around me was just everybody else.
Uh-huh.
But he was Woody.
I mean, there was no one else but one.
Yeah.
And that was he. And I think if I may venture an opinion, there's no one else but one to hear, and you, Bob.
That, of course, was Bob Dylan talking about Woody Guthrie and seeing Woody Guthrie as a little boy. What was Bob Dylan like?
Yeah, well, of course, I knew Woody very well, much better than I knew Dylan. The time I interviewed Bob was one time, one of his earliest, 63. He was 22 years old.
22.
I remember the first words I said, where have you been, Cotton Eye Joe? That's your greeting. But he spoke of a certain song. First of all, the influence of Woody on him. And then he sang the song, Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And he says every line of that song could be the subject of a different song. But there was one line that knocked my wife out for a loop, and the line was, the executioner's face is always well hidden. And that line, you think naturally, the guillotine, the guy who wields the axe has a mask over his face, the guy who hangs people has a mask over his face. And today, thanks to technology and bombings from afar, the executioner's face may be celebrated. Maybe a high official. at the same time, it need not be well hidden. It is there.
Mm-hmm.
And so that phrase, and the way he could use that phrase, is what distinguished him. But his tribute to Woody is one I remember best. See, so they have to say Bob Dylan did not come out of the womb whole. He was influenced by others.
Yeah.
And Woody, I think, I'd call the balladeer of the Great Depression.
Well, the documentary that this caller just referred to, I saw some of it too, that just recently aired on some public stations, done by Martin Scorsese, really showed that influence that Woody Guthrie had on Bob Dylan. It was very interesting, and I hadn't realized the degree to which he'd been influenced by him until then. Just one second, let me remind our audience that you're listening
to... Oh, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Just want to tell them that you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Go ahead.
Woody was his own kind of poet. Like following Caruso, I'd have Louis Armstrong. Then have Woody doing, say, Tom Joad. Now, Tom Joad is one of the Dust Bowl ballads. Tom, we know, the hero of Grapes of Wrath. In 6 minutes, it's two sides of a 10-inch, 78 RPM. In those 6 minutes, he captures the whole novel, the key, all the revelatory moments of John Steinbeck's 600 or so page book. It's astonishing. At the end, he says goodbye to his mother that he loved. Remember the great line? She says, Mama, where am I going to find you? We know he's going to be an organizer. He goes off. She says, wherever the kid's hungry for bread, crying for bread, I'll be there. Wherever men eat the crops they raise, live in the homes they build, I'll be there. So you'll know I am, Mother, so, et cetera.
But, all right, let's see if we can get one more call in before we have to let you go. We're going to go to Art in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Art.
Good afternoon. My grandfather was Caruso's personal physician in New York, and in 1917, Caruso drew a caricature in black and white sketch that I still have here in my home. Caruso drew it of my grandfather. I'm wondering, first of all, did you know that Caruso had that talent, because it's a wonderful sketch? And did you find that other people whose principal talent was known to folks had other hidden talents that they were equally good at?
I'm sure they were, but you pointed out something very good. He was a wonderful cartoonist, a caricaturist. He had that. There are several others I can't think of at the moment, I'm sure, who had similar qualities of cartooning and drawing. But Caruso is one of the best cases in point. And so there you are. Here's someone very close. You know, he died prematurely. He was doing Samson Delilah. Funny thing is, he pulled the pillars down. The pillars fell. But by that time, I think he had a cancer that was incurable. But he... See, you start naming these people, and they are giants, each in his her own way. Before I... check out, as we say, check out in many ways. And then before that, I said the gospel songs followed the Civil War, the gospel songs of the North. Now the spirituals were slavery songs. They were code songs. They were right out of Scripture, Old and New Testament. Didn't my Lord deliver Daniel, and why not every man? Or swing those sweet chariot coming for to carry me home. Well, that sweet chariot could be the Underground Railway.
Yeah. Let me just thank Art for calling in. I hope you got your question answered. Thanks so much for
your
call, Art. Just, you know, when you look back at these interviews, is there, you said there's not one, but are there is there a moment you remember or that you really cherish from some of these interviews? Is there one you can think of?
Well, so many, you know, hearing the guys Gillespie and Parker playing for the first time and inventing a new form called exploring the instrument even further, bop. But I see, to me, a moment is a singer named Claudia Muzio. And people think of Callas as the great Violetta and Traviata, and she was, but not better than Muzio, who sang at the opera company in Chicago a couple of times. Muzio, in the opera's dying, the courtesan, is reading a letter of apology from the rich guy whose son was in love with her, and she was in love with, she was a courtesan. And he says she's got to leave, his son has to leave her because She ruined the family's name. And she reads the letter of apology from the old man. And then she starts singing the song, Addio del Passato, Farewell Then Forever. As she reads that letter in Italian, you'd think Eleonora Duse, the greatest of all actresses, was doing it. That, to me, is one of the high moments ever.
Studs Terkel, it was great having you with me today. Enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Studs Terkel's latest book is And They All Sang, Adventures of an Eclectic Disc Jockey. I'm Lynn Neary. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.